Hi, this is Scott Propp. Thanks for joining me today. And this is the three required ingredients for successful growth projects webinar. Peter Drucker put it that the only true purpose of a business is to create a customer. And the truth is that a growth program is really in place to create a new customer with a variation of existing product, or an old customer served in a new way with a variation of that product. And the truth is that finding these growth projects, forming them and implementing them is really the new competitive battlefield. The days of relatively static business model systems and processes are well behind us. And the ability to find clarity, practicality, and put these in place is really the key new battlefield. If you think about companies even as big as Amazon, for instance, they had to make a huge pivot into mobile advertising. That is the kind of thing we're talking about. Why is this so important? What's happening in the world that's really driving this interest in developing growth programs? The researcher Richard Foster put a note out there the other day that said 75% of the S&P 500 will be replaced by 2027. That is a stunning statistic. In a little over a decade, 75% of the publicly traded companies that we see on the S&P 500 will not exist in the form that they're in. Closer in, we see Intel shedding 10 to 12,000 jobs based on lack of growth. Apple stock down 30%, right? A bellwether innovation company. So it's incredibly important for us as growth leaders to take this on. This is very real, practical stuff. There is more competition than ever. And in the old days, you could count on some secular growth. You could count on kind of treading water for a little while and waiting for that secular growth to come through and lift you up and take you along with it. But the truth is that in this economy, we're really beginning to see the rewards for differential value creation. And the pathway to do that is implementing growth programs. The last reason this is important is there's a war out there on talent. I'm seeing it in every client I work with and every locale I work with. Retaining creative individuals, even for name organizations, is getting to be very, very tough. And talent recognizes quickly when the vibrancy for growth and renewal is lost inside the organization. So having these kinds of programs and techniques in place is becoming absolutely key and very important. Now, when I talk with people, they always assume that their challenges are unique, that their organizational context is unique and the pressures to complete specific activities are unique. But I found over the three decades I've been doing this work that there is a pattern and there are some very specific essentials that need to be in place. Now, if you step back for a minute, you think about the early days of an organization and the first dozen to 50 employees, everybody's very close to the customer and has a really good feeling for tracking where that customer is heading. But as the organization grows, what happens is layers of insulation begin to take over, and human beings are pattern-making machines. So as human beings, we begin to establish these routines, and we tend to serve one another relationally, which tends to create very resilient organizations, some might say fixed organizations, in what they can do. The avatar then that is served inside these organizations as a customer is the avatar that the individual knew when they were closest to the edge. And then we begin to compensate people and provide incentives for them to serve this avatar even more and more. And that only tightens up the resilience of the organization. The good news is that the way we move organizations from that specific lock-in on an avatar to a new avatar is to go find that new individual inside an avatar, and we're going to talk some today about that. And the three elements that are essential in doing that are the right project, the right team, and the right plan. If any one of those three elements is missing, what happens is you wind up consuming a lot of resources without getting the benefits on your P&L statement for the good work that's been done. So in the most common case, you'd be having a substantial amount of R&D and insight on the shelf that's not getting through and implemented into the system. That is a very expensive event to continue to do without seeing the benefits of that through the whole system. Again, any one element of this, the three that we're going to talk about in a moment is missing, you will have a resource drain. So I'm going to take you through these three elements right now. The first one being the right project. The right project is the core to these activities. It drives everything. There's really two key elements to the right project. There's many nuances, but the two underlying essentials are it must be customer focused. And what the tricky bit is a customer that's probably in your periphery right now. And developing that insight, finding that customer that's on the periphery takes some hard work. I do workshops on a very formal basis with clients to take them to the edge of their client base and begin to identify some of those new areas. In some cases, we have to go to the edge of the economics and the new market formation to find these clients and customers. One of the key search tools is simply getting out and building new insight around the edges of the organization, not being so focused on the core value proposition. And one of the quick ways that you know you're onto something is when there's energy coming back across the table. When you attend a new conference or you sit with a new individual and they begin to light up as you're having that dialogue, it's one of the first early markers that you are onto an insight. And building on those insights, I notice I'm not using the word ideas because ideas are usually internally generated. Insights are discovered externally. Building those insights together is the first element of a good project. The second key piece is successful growth projects are always built on elements of the DNA inside the firm. Now, as the firm is built, we tend to build these groups inside, R&D, product development, manufacturing, distribution, marketing, and sales. And as we build these pieces, they tend to become very specialized engines at serving our core client base. A successful growth program really involves taking elements of those, taking the best of those elements and redirecting them to a new client space. So understanding what that DNA is, taking it apart, and then thinking about how to take the best of that forward, what unfair advantage you can take to this newly discovered insight is the second major element of getting the right project. A firm rarely knows what it's good at. There are a number of things that as you begin to peel this apart, you find expertise and layers of competence that you're unaware of. So the question for this element always is, you know, what are the resilient pieces of the organization that you can use in this? A classic mistake is retasking the full organization to a new area. It's a tremendous change management issue. There's a lot of human inertia involved. It's much better architecturally to take the great results that group is creating and utilize them in a new way. You know, we build them in the way that they're built because they deliver consistent value. They deliver consistent shareholder value. The reason people buy our stock and our stakeholders like us is we can deliver consistent value. Take the consistent value that those modules are creating and rewire it to serve the new client base rather than trying to bend the whole organization. An example of this from my background, we're in a private communications area where we were serving the ISP, the Internet Service Provider space, cutthroat environment, margins were declining, very difficult space to be in. So we began scanning the edges of the market to see if there were some opportunities. And one of the things we found out is we had a very robust state and local marketing presence that allowed us to get into some departments of transportation. Began chatting with them and found out that they were woefully underserved in terms of data. They were using, you know, at the time, wireline communications from the telephone company. They were unreliable. They were difficult to troubleshoot. There's a whole lot of significant issues with that. We teamed up in a joint development effort with some of the thought leaders that we found by attending conferences in the space and began to explore what would be useful. We thought it would be a slam dunk. We'd simply take our ISP equipment and provide it into this new market. As we got deeper into it, we discovered that there was a lot more to it. We needed to make the equipment much simpler. We had to be able to deploy it without significant technical competence, wireless competence on site, so you know, one button setups. We had to redesign the hardware so you could handle it with leather gloves on and out of a bucket truck in bad weather environments. And once we started to do that, two things happened. One is the equipment became very desirable and the word spread in that small new market. And the second thing was we had a pretty defendable niche because naturally all the competitors tried to chase over there. And the minute they'd unboxed the unit, they realized that there was a big difference between what we were doing and what they were doing. And there was a real affinity developed. One of the questions or one of the areas to think about in this space is, are you having trouble connecting with a salesperson to take you into these new accounts? That's an early sign that you're going to have some trouble on the distribution side of the channel. So think that through. Think about how you can connect these new projects up. So that's module one, the project. Now, having a good project formed, the second key piece is a team. There's two elements to the team. One is having the leverage to be able to do the rewiring that we talked about a moment ago. And second is the breadth to execute on the insight. So let's talk about the leverage for a second. A good leader on a growth program has enough altitude to be able to affect everything that needs to be done inside the organization, and they need to have good sponsorship. A sponsor is at enough altitude in the organization that they can influence all their peers to participate and get what needs to be done in the growth program. And secondly, they can hold off the metric-driven organization long enough so that this nascent organization can go ahead and get the growth work done. This takes some significant stamina and talent to be able to do this. So the two critical roles at the outset are a good sponsor and a good team leader. One of the key tells here is if you've incubated something yourself as a middle management or mid-senior manager and you want to take it forward, if you're having trouble recruiting a sponsor, it usually means that you've done the work in step one, the project work, not well enough. Because these are career risks, and there needs to be enough risk-reward ratio to generate good sponsorship to make these things go forward. Second element of right team is it needs to have the span to do the full amount of work. The most common way teams go off track is they're very narrow. A narrow functional specialty just continues to develop and develop and develop a particular area that they have interest in. And to implement it, you need everything from supply chain all the way through manufacturing, sales, distribution, all the way out, and including a client participant. Without the full breadth of that full chain, you will not be able to tee up all the various issues that are involved. And any area affected needs to be in there up front. Don't forget about groups like legal, finance, HR. Those can become significant blockages downstream and can actually force you to rework your program late in the structure. One of the questions I always ask at this point in the program when people are beginning to form these things is, are they getting volunteers? Because there is a underlying network of good people in the organization. When they hear about this kind of stuff going on, you will begin to receive efforts like, I want to be on that team. That's a really good sign that you've got the project scope right and that the team is coming together. Without that, those volunteers showing up, I would begin to perhaps think about getting a little bit deeper. The second thing is, second big tell here is that when you're working with that outside client, on the really good ones, they're going to want to bring their friends to the party as well. You're going to start seeing volunteers outside the organization. When you begin to get that pulled together, you know that you've got something very strong. One of the applications of this, just to pull it together, we did a lot of work on technology shelf stuff in a prior life. And one of the key experimental learnings was that it took a board of directors to really be able to successfully bridge the gap between the people that were developing the insight and actually getting it into the landing zone. If you don't have the full spectrum of that represented in a board, the early questions that are going to provide late resistance never get asked. And at getting those questions out on the table in a repeated quarterly update as these programs progress is really, really important. And a board of directors environment will give you the leverage, give the leader the opportunity to get decisions made. And if the full board is sitting there, it's very hard to pocket veto things. You know, it's either a yes or a no. And pocket vetoes are one of the quickest ways that these things tend to go off track. So the last question I'll ask you in this section is, if you're working on a program, is someone from outside ready to join on? That is usually a good validation that you're on top of a project and you're putting together a team to deliver. Excellent. All right, third element, the right plan. This is the third essential. Two, again, dimensions here. One is that the plan needs to be structured by risk, and it needs to be structured by validating the insight. So the reason it's so important to have that full team breadth is it takes the full team to surface all the risks that are involved in the program, and none of them are too small. So getting the whole team together and getting that risk established. Some of you have worked with tornado charts. They're essentially just a stack ranking of values. Putting that together for risk and going to work on those risk elements in priority order versus other potential stack rankings is really important. The second piece to make this program work with the existing operationally oriented leaders is tranched investments. Making sure that a specific amount of money is going to be spent to get a specific outcome and a specific learning, followed by a review, followed by a new tranche of funds to go learn some more. Running growth programs in this mode versus a continuous drip is very, very useful, especially in organizations that are very operationally oriented. These clear and crisp points of departure and landing zones across the tranches, and making sure that for every dollar spent, your insight is getting more validated and your risk level is going down. Every good insight hides behind risks, and every good risk that's taken apart results in more learning. So getting through these and getting through these quickly in this kind of environment, very, very useful. So the three questions in this area, is your work targeted at validating your insight? You know, when you complete a milestone, do you know more about your market and your product than you did before? Secondly, does each milestone decrease risk when you start crossing things off the chart? Are you taking them off in a useful way? And second, or third, do you have line of sight to the resources for the next step? You don't have to have all the resources on at the start of the product. You obviously need to have a critical mass to get started, but as long as you have line item insight to those resources, you can go ahead and have at it. So we are at a point here where I will be going into some of the Q&A that you guys have been teeing up. Thank you. They've been coming in. I appreciate that. I'm going to, after Q&A, I'll close with three action steps, and then we'll go ahead and talk about some of the things. I'm going to send you an email after this webinar. Oh, this is a good one. How soon do we need to form the full team? The minute you have the business hypothesis, when you have that if-then statement, if we take this action on product, we can serve these customers. Or if we take this particular set of new customers and serve them, we can have this happen. As soon as you have that hypothesis, you should begin filling out the project brief and begin thinking about who those key participants will be. I always encourage a minimum team size of 3 to 5 just to get things started. And they need to be team people. They need to be good at gluing things together. They need to be relationally solid, not afraid to have conversations outside their area of expertise. And they have to have a significant amount of expertise represented in their specialist area. So the answer is form the critical mass first and then begin reaching out right away. And it will become evident. It will become evident as you begin to move through the milestones just how soon you need the full team. Next question. One is a good one as well. Scott, give us your perspective on signs, when to pull the plug and move on versus when to revamp the proposal and the pitch. So the couple of things I think of, and one of the useful parts of forming a project in this way, is you will have a hypothesis that you are working to. Now, if we do this in this particular market, we're expecting this outcome. I am a big fan of really examining early deviations to that, both positively and negatively. usually, as these deviations occur, it points to specific issues in terms of how we're going to either take this thing to market or be able to complete the technical or service development model to be able to deliver them. And I'm a big fan of taking action early and providing either additional expertise or gathering additional insight. And if you can't get back to the benchmarks, it's time to walk it back to the point where you need to reestablish and recharter the team. One of the key issues in putting in tranches is it keeps your resource spend very specific for a specific amount of learning. So by doing that, you will limit your exposure for total enterprise. And truthfully, that, you know, when you find things that aren't working, that is learning too. It is very rare on any of these programs that you take off and walk a linear path to success. There is almost always one or two pivots along that arc. And understanding that those are going to happen and chartering the team to move through them is key. But you know, any kind of key milestone slippage, any kind of change in forecast, any kind of change in customer environment, really begs the question of getting the team back together and taking a look. I encourage everyone to go through their portfolio process every 90 days to go through the full stack ranking and make sure everything's still on benchmarks. If you do that well, chances are that you'll quickly resolve anything that's out there. So thanks for that question. Here's a related question. Should we fund programs without a landing zone? Early on, I made the comment that it's always good and, in fact, highly valuable to have the landing zone in mind. And one of the reasons it is that that landing zone brings some very specific understanding of how much margin there needs to be for the distribution players to be excited to take your product forward and so forth. Some very specific benchmarks that the team, the development team probably typically doesn't understand well. So I am a big fan of having a specific landing zone or a specific set of market metrics to work into. Any investment guy will tell you, don't buy an investment without having an exit plan. And the kind of investments we're talking about here are not just research investments, but we're talking about investments of scale. And they quickly grow. These things quickly grow and become expensive as you're moving to scale and moving to market. So the trigger points here need to be a little bit lower, and I would really ask a lot of questions before I put any significant investment in something without a landing zone. any tips for bulletproofing the program? That's a fun one. My short answer to those is it's really in the due diligence process. And if you've heard me speak on other topics before, I really encourage people to go visit the spot where the bullets will come from. Typically, there is a curmudgeon in the organization somewhere that has seen it all, done it all, has a lot of history, and has a lot to offer. And a lot of times people are loath to go and have a chat with that individual. And I can tell you from experience that there's a lot of good information there. So I always ask the question, you know, who have you talked about either within the organization or outside the organization that has a lot of history in the space? The second thing that I would encourage you to do is don't be bashful about bringing the CFO in early. That's usually the one that people are reluctant to do. And CFOs are truth tellers. They're not always easy people to do work with. But when they're on board from the beginning and they understand the benchmarks you're working to and you're honest about the risks that you're working into, you'll find them to be some of the best work partners. So, that's a great question. Bulletproofing your program. I probably will use that. Thank you for offering that. So we've done most of our work today. We've got our 9 questions on. The 2 essentials, I want to make sure that I touch on that so I don't miss them. We're in the last bullet, talking about risks and making sure that our projects are risk oriented and tranched are the 2 things that are really ROI boosters. As you go through new product portfolio analysis, and I do quite a bit of this stuff, one of the spots you find is that ROI zooms when you have very careful investment strategies that are risk-based and tranched. The last question in the webinar invitation was the secret marker in how to assess the health of your growth project. And that secret marker really is that volunteer factor I talked about. When you have outside people that come on board and volunteer for your program, and you have clients, either upstream suppliers or downstream customers that want to be part of it, that is a very, very good marker. Second question that just came in here, how do you promote speed in this model? I get the tranches aspect and I get the kill switch and fail fast approach, but what about getting a higher and higher volume of growth projects to flow to the flow to completion? So this really gets into how do you run the innovation process in a larger organization. The key with that really is having what I would call almost a assembly line process that takes a fixed amount of projects through the organization on a cadence. So if you have, for instance, a quarterly review of programs, at each of those sessions, you should be activating a specific amount of programs to be carried along in your process. And whatever your cycle time is, whatever, you know, if you're in the software business, you might be doing sprints every couple of weeks. If you're in the heavy equipment business, these things probably are measured in months. But you should have things moving along, whatever the cadence of your organization is. The trick here is, and the thing I find in most organizations, that they don't activate enough new programs and they don't remove their zombies quickly enough. So what happens is there's this muddle in the middle of stuff that's been activated that begins to clog the ability for the organization to execute. So usually the first step in that is a real honest review of what's in the system and reducing the workload on the system of these new projects so that it can begin flowing again. And then having a real careful, disciplined approach on the front end of the gate of not overloading those elements. And then if you have the ability to custom scale the programs, then setting very tight boundaries for key steps and scaling the investment as the ROI and business model proof case is executed is it would be the second thing I would say there. So thank you. Great questions. Okay, so we are right about where I wanted to be time-wise. Well, let's go ahead and move towards a wrap up here. So, one last question. How to best interest in organizations looking openly and deeply into external insights? So external scanning is always tricky. I have a very disciplined program I call the Future Capability Process to go after that. The three steps in that are really the internal scan that we talked about. How do you get the DNA established? And then once those specific areas of interest are established, going out and finding those lighthouse advisors that are outside the boundaries of the organization, that are the thought leaders that can speak into that space, and asking them for some input. Usually the way I coach my clients to do this is to develop a question set internally, go put that question set to the outside thought leaders and bring those essays back inside the organization. By doing that, there's then a third phase where you take the future inputs, which are always provocative and never exactly on target because nobody knows the future exactly, and building those into the DNA that you then understand, you wind up with the third phase of the program, which is really activating some beta projects. So kind of using that discipline scan to look forward and deeper allows you to assemble these beta projects that are probably richer and better, certainly better informed than you could create out of your own internal DNA. Thank you. Okay, so let's go ahead and wrap up. So in the exit email, you'll receive a little copy of a Growth Zone checklist. This is a piece that covers some of the things we talked about today, but is just a darn nice checklist to take to reviews. It gives you a sense of what I think about in terms of the project, the team, and the activity reviews. I'll give you a nice start forward on that. There'll be a couple other bonus pieces as well. There's a piece I wrote called 12 Questions to Ask Now to Make Sure Your Growth Plans Don't Get Derailed. And it's just full of, again, insight and questions that I've used with real programs and clients. And then secondly, a second piece called Straight Talk for Senior Leaders Who Need to Clear the Path for Growth. And again, there will be some elements in there that you can take and apply right away. So I thank you very much for spending some time with me this morning. It's been fun, and I look forward to interacting with you guys. Feel free to reach out to me at scott@scottprop.com. My Twitter handle is @scottprop, and there's 5 articles a day that come down the Twitter stream. And for those of you that are Twitter fans, many of you are probably on LinkedIn. And if you link up with me on LinkedIn, there's 2 articles a day that come down my feed on LinkedIn and in development innovation. So if you have additional inquiries in depth, I'd love to chat with you. You'll receive this recording, I believe, within a few minutes. This is a new technology package we're using here, so we're not quite sure how responsive it'll be. And I know the recording will be available for at least 48 hours for those of you that would like to review it. So again, thanks very much, and have a fantastic day.